This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Fierce Conversations, Achieving Success at Work and in Life, One Conversation at a Time, by Susan Scott. Read by the author.
Hello, I'm Susan Scott. If you're about to listen to this program, it may be because the conversations you've been having with your coworkers or with your family members often fail to produce the results you want. Over 10,000 hours of one-to-one conversations with industry leaders, as well as workshops with men and women from all walks of life confronting issues of relationship and life direction, have convinced me that our work, our relationships, and in fact our very lives, succeed or fail gradually, then suddenly, one conversation at a time. Equally provocative has been my realization that while no single conversation is guaranteed to change the trajectory of a business, a career, a marriage, or a life, any single conversation can. This program is a guide to tackling your toughest challenges and enriching relationships with everyone important to your success and happiness through the principles, tools, and assignments designed to direct you through your first fierce conversations with yourself onto the most challenging and important conversations facing you. By the end of this program, you will have become highly skilled at crafting deeply rewarding professional and personal relationships, one conversation at a time. Whether you intend to maintain positive results in your life or turn things around, considering all of the conversations you need to have could feel a bit discouraging, so let's take the curse off the somewhat daunting field of communications. I'd like you to simply take it one conversation at a time, beginning with a person who next stands in front of you. Perhaps there are very few conversations in between you and what you desire. We'll take it principle by principle. Once you master the courage and the skills, and more important, enjoy the benefits of fierce conversations, there will be no going back. It could change the world. It will certainly change your world. Be patient with yourself, though. You got here, wherever here is, one conversation at a time. Allow the changes needed, at home or at work, to reveal themselves one conversation at a time. Sometimes here just happens, following the high-tech carnage, crashing economies, corporate layoffs, and terrorist attacks of 2001. It would be easy to conclude that life has grown too unpredictable, that there's nothing to do but hang on and muddle through as best you can. Perhaps you received a major wake-up call. You lost your biggest customer, the one that counted for 40% of your net profit. Or you lost your most valued employee. Or you lost your job and it wasn't due to a layoff. You lost the loyalty of your team. You lost your 18-year marriage. Or the cohesiveness of your family. To experience what happens for many individuals and organizations facing challenges, put your right arm out and point your finger, then visualize pointing it at someone who is the bane of your professional or personal life right now. That's called the accountability shuffle. He did it, she did it, they did it to me. Blame isn't the answer, nor is cocooning in the perceived safety of your home. Once you reflect on the path that led you to a disappointing or difficult point in place and time, you may remember, often in vivid detail, the conversation that set things in motion, ensuring you would end up exactly where you find yourself today. It is very likely that you arrived at this destination one failed conversation at a time. So many times I've heard people say, "We never addressed the real issue, never came to terms with reality." Or, We never stated our needs. We never told each other what we were really thinking and feeling. In the end, there were so many things we needed to talk about, the wheels came off the cart. Take your finger and touch your nose. This is where the resolution begins. This is the accountable position. If you want to make progress towards a better here in your professional or personal life, identify the conversations out there with your name on them and resolve to have them with all the courage, grace, and vulnerability they require. And on the positive side, you finally landed that huge customer, the one your competition would kill for, or you successfully recruited a valuable new employee, or you enjoy a deeply fulfilling relationship. You're clear and passionate about your life. You got to this good place in your life, this satisfying career path, this terrific relationship, gradually, then suddenly, one successful conversation at a time, perhaps one marvelously fierce conversation at a time. And now you are determined to ensure the quality of your ongoing conversations with the people central to your success and happiness. If you want better results at home or at work, you've come to the right place. After listening to this program, gathering your courage, and working with the tools we'll explore together, you will return to your colleagues at work, to your partner at home, and most important, to yourself, prepared to engage in ongoing, groundbreaking conversations that will profoundly transform your life. Each of us must first discard the notion that we respond differently depending on whom we're with, and that our work and home conversations are really quite different. When you squeeze an orange, what comes out of it? Orange juice. Why? Because that's what's inside it. The orange doesn't care whether it's on a boardroom table or beside the kitchen sink. It doesn't leak orange juice at home and tomato juice at work. When we get squeezed, when things aren't going well for us, what comes out of us? Whatever's inside us. To pretend that what's going on in our personal lives can be boxed, taped shut, and left in the garage while we are at work is hogwash. It seeps in everywhere. Who we are is who we are all over the place. So if your conversations at work are yielding disappointing results, I'd be willing to bet you're getting similar results at home. The principles and skills needed to engage in conversations that produce mind-blowing, world-class results in the workplace are exactly the same principles and skills that produce mind-blowing, world-class results at home. Going hand in hand with the discovery that our lives succeed or fail one conversation at a time is a second insight, courtesy of poet and author David White. David suggests that in the typical marriage, the young man newly married is often frustrated that this person with whom he intends to enjoy the rest of his life seemingly needs to talk yet again about the same thing they talked about last weekend, and it often has something to do with their relationship. The young man wonders, why are we talking about this again? I thought we settled it. Couldn't we just have one huge conversation about our relationship and then coast for a year or two? Apparently not. And eventually, if he is paying attention, it occurs to him, White suggests, that this ongoing, robust conversation I have been having with my wife is not about the relationship. The conversation is the relationship. If the conversation stops, if it becomes muted or less authentic, or if we add yet another topic to the list of things we are unable to talk about because it wrecks another weekend, then all of the possibilities for the relationship become smaller, and all of the possibilities for the individuals in the relationship become smaller. Until one day, I overhear myself in mid-sentence making myself smaller in every encounter, behaving as if I am just the space around my shoes, engaged in yet another 3-minute conversation so empty of meaning it crackles. If we lower the standards about how often we talk, what we talk about, and most important, the degree of authenticity we bring to our conversations. It's a slow and deadly slide. Many work teams, as well as couples, have a list of undiscussables, issues they avoid broaching at all costs in order to preserve a modicum of peace, to preserve the relationship. In reality, the relationship steadily deteriorates for lack of the very conversations they so carefully avoid. It's difficult to raise the bar if the slide has lasted over a period of years, and that's what keeps many of us stuck. In our significant relationships, in the workplace and in our conversations with others, we'd like to tell the truth. We'd like to be able to successfully tackle the topic that's keeping us stuck or apart, but the task is too hard. We don't know how to avoid the all-too-familiar outcome of talks gone south. Besides, we've learned to live with it. Why wreck another meeting with our colleagues, another weekend with our life partner, trying to resolve the tough issues or answer the big questions? We're tired and we just want peace in the land. The problem is, whether you are running an organization or your life, you are required to be responsive to your world, and that response often requires change. We affect change by engaging in robust conversations with ourselves and others. But what is a fierce conversation? Doesn't fear suggest menacing, cruel, threatening? Sounds like raised voices, blood on the floor, no fun at all. In Roget's thesaurus, however, the word fierce has the following synonyms: robust, intense, powerful, passionate, eager, uncurbed. In its simplest form, a fierce conversation is one in which we come out from behind ourselves into the conversation and make it real. While many are afraid of real, it is the unreal conversation that should scare us to death. Whoever said talk is cheap was mistaken. Unreal conversations are incredibly expensive for organizations and for individuals. Every organization wants to feel it's having a real conversation with its employees, its customers, its territory, and with the unknown future that is emerging around it. Each individual wants to have conversations that are somehow building his or her world of meaning. What I've witnessed over and over is that when the conversation is real, the change occurs before the conversation has even ended. Being real is not the risk. The real risk is that I will be known. I will be seen. I will be changed. Think about it. What are the conversations you've been unable or unwilling to have with your boss, colleague, employee, customer, with your husband, wife, parent, child, or with yourself, that if you were able to have, might change everything? Fierce conversations figure prominently in both my own work and personal life. For 13 years, I worked with corporate leaders through the auspices of Tech International, an organization dedicated to increasing the effectiveness and enhancing the lives of CEOs. Thousands of CEOs in 18 countries meet for monthly one-to-one conversations with someone like myself to focus on their businesses and lives, from budgets, strategies, personnel, and profitability, to faltering marriages, health issues, or kids who are upside down. 12 conversations over the course of a year with each CEO. Since time is a CEO's most precious commodity, it seemed essential that our time together be qualitatively different than time spent with others. Each conversation needed to accomplish something useful. My success and that of my peers depended on our ability to engage leaders in conversations that provoked significant change. As my practice of robust conversations became increasingly compelling to me, I imagined that I was turning into a conversational cartographer, mapping a way toward deepening authenticity for myself and for those who wanted to join me. The CEOs with whom I worked became increasingly candid, and with that candor came a growing sense of personal freedom, vitality, and effectiveness. The most successful leaders invariably determine to engage in an ongoing, robust conversation with themselves, paying fierce attention to their work and lives, resulting in a high level of personal authenticity, emotional honesty, and a greater capacity to hold true to their vision and enroll others in it. Over time, I recognized that we were exploring core principles, which, when embraced, dramatically change lives, one conversation at a time. Fierce conversations are about moral courage, clear requests, and taking action. Fierce is an attitude, a way of conducting business, a way of life. Many times I hear words to this effect. A fierce conversation is like the first parachute jump from an airplane. In anticipation, you perspire and your mouth goes dry. Once you've left the plane, it's an adrenaline rush that is indescribable. Or this. This weekend, my wife and I had the best conversation we've had in 10 years. It feels like falling in love all over again. As a result of constant urging from clients and colleagues to write down this life-changing stuff, I began to assemble my notes, to put on paper what I'd been practicing for more than a decade. This program emerged as a roadmap for each listener's highly individualized journey. Once you master the courage and the skills and begin to enjoy the benefits of fierce conversations, they will become a way of life, the way of your life. Let's begin. We'll be looking at the 7 principles of fierce conversations.
Principle 1. Master the courage to interrogate reality.
No plan survives its collision with reality. The problem is, reality has an irritating habit of shifting at work and at home, seriously complicating our favorite fantasies. And reality generally wins, whether it's the reality of the marketplace, the reality of a spouse's changing needs, or the reality of our own physical or emotional well-being. The world changes. You and I change. Business colleagues, life partners, friends, customers, we are all changing all the time. As Lillian Hellman wrote, people change and forget to tell one another. Not only do we neglect to share this with others, we are skilled at masking it to ourselves. It's no wonder relationships disintegrate. The traditional practice of annual strategic planning sessions is a thing of the past. It no longer works for a company's executive team to spend 2 days on retreat, determine their goals, roll out an action plan, and call it a year. The team members must reconvene quarterly to address the question, what has changed since last we met? As a company president recently admitted, I'd like to get a firm grasp on reality, but somebody keeps moving it. The best we can hope for, to quote business consultant Robert Bridges, is the masterful administration of the unforeseen. Stuff happens, internally, externally. Some you can affect, some you can't. From working closely with corporate leaders, I know very well how quickly reality can change. The customer responsible for 50% of your business files for bankruptcy. Your most valuable employee is recruited away from you. Your competition comes out with a great new whiz-bang product that you are not prepared to match or beat. New technology renders your product or service obsolete. The economy goes upside down. You go upside down, lost in the complexity of your organization's goals and challenges. It would seem companies are stressed either because their sales are too low or because their sales are too high. As individuals, we are stressed either because we don't have enough of the things we want or because we have all of the things we want. We are either shedding or acquiring. Either way, happiness eludes us. Or perhaps you realize that you're operating at a new level of effectiveness in a particular area of your life. Life feels like your favorite class at school with a rush of learning every day. You've received a promotion or you've fallen in love with a wonderful person. whatever it is, something spectacular has happened and you don't want to blow it. Let's face it, the world will not be managed. Life is curly. Don't try to straighten it out. Whether you are running an organization or participating in a committed relationship, you will find yourself continually thwarted in your best efforts to accomplish the goals of the team unless reality is regularly and thoroughly examined. You know this. Describing reality, however, can get complicated. Let me tell you what I mean. Think of your company as a beach ball. Picture the beach ball as having a red stripe, a green stripe, a yellow stripe, and a blue stripe. Let's imagine that you are the president of the company. You're standing on the blue stripe. The blue stripe is where you live every day, day after day. If someone asks you what color your company is, you look down around your feet and tell them, "My company is blue." How do you know that? You're surrounded by blue. From where you stand, the company is as blue as it gets. Cobalt blue, to be precise. So here you are, in a meeting, laying out your strategy to launch an exciting new project. And of course, you're explaining that this strategy is brilliant because it takes into consideration the blueness of the company. Your CFO listens intently. Her brow is furrowed. She lives on the red stripe. All day, she's up to her armpits in red. Cash flow is tight. She takes a deep breath and ventures, "I'm excited about this project, but when I hear you describe our company as blue, I wonder if you've studied the latest cash flow projection. I'm dealing with a lot of red these days. Can we talk about this?" While many leaders do not welcome opposing views, you are highly evolved, so you respond, "Okay, put that red on the table and let's take a look at it." And the debate is on. Blue, red, blue, red, blue, red. Meanwhile, your director of manufacturing is starting to squirm. He lives on the green stripe. He is thinking, "Man, oh man, the timing on this project couldn't be worse. But every time I share concerns, I'm viewed as a naysayer. Besides, it's nearly lunchtime and no one will thank me for complicating this conversation even further." Your VP of engineering, who lives on the yellow stripe, has a strongly held differing opinion. But his experience has taught him that differences of opinion lead to raised voices and strong emotions, after which someone dies. In his experience, for some people, win-win translates to, I win again." And the last time he stuck his toe over the line with a controversial idea, the most vocal member of the team shot it off. So this key executive, who is privy to useful information, pulls off an amazing feat. He shrinks his subatomic particles and disappears. This is possible, you know. Think about all the times a meeting has ended and you found yourself trying to remember if your VP of engineering was present. He was. He just made himself invisible. Some people are extraordinarily talented at this. They may be brilliant. But disappointingly, they neither fish nor cut bait. They are neither hot nor cold. They appear to be, at best, politely indifferent. The ability to hide out at meetings was so prevalent at one company that the behavior eventually got a name. Picture a leader holding forth from one end of the boardroom table. She is espousing the cleverness of the current strategy. Like all good leaders, at some point she offers an opportunity for others to respond, something like, "So what do you think?" It gets quiet around the table, unnaturally quiet. Around the table, eyes fall. Each individual practices the art of personal stealth technology, attempting to drop beneath the leader's radar screen. At one point, the leader calls on some poor bloke who is less skilled at vanishing than his team members. "Jim, what do you think of the plan?" Jim gets that look on his face like a cat occupied in the litter box, sort of far away as if to indicate that he is not really here and neither are you. The leader waits Jim out. Jim has to do something. Jim nods. His head moves up and down as he gazes fixedly at a spot on the boardroom table. The leader smiles. And what about you, Elaine? The leader persists. Elaine steps into the litter box, head down, eyes averted. She nods. And so forth around the table as the leader scans the room. The corporate nod. Satisfied, the leader concludes, good, we launch on Monday. In the funnies, characters' thought bubbles float overhead, capturing the unfiltered notions bobbing about in their heads. We love the Dilbert comic strip because the characters actually say what they're thinking, and it's often what we have thought ourselves. If we could read the thought bubbles floating over the heads of people sitting around the boardroom table, the very people charged with implementing the strategy, we might see, there's no way we can do that. This is crazy. We don't know what people are thinking unless they tell us. And even then, there's no guarantee they're telling us what they really think. Yet, if asked, most people avow that they want to hear the truth, even if it is unpalatable. A friend who is a high-level executive, intimidating to many, recently promoted a courageous employee who walked into his office with a large bucket of sand and poured it on the rug. "What the hell are you doing?" demanded my friend. The employee replied, "I just figured I'd make it easier for you to bury your head in the sand on the topic I keep bringing up and you keep avoiding." You can be assured this employee would not have taken such a bold and risky step if he were not convinced that the company was about to embark on a road to ruin. After a sleepless night, he had determined that he owed it to himself, his colleagues, his customers, and his leader to either make himself heard or leave the organization. He told his boss, "Everyone's in basket and out basket are full, but I'm concerned we're avoiding the too hard basket." The conversation following this outrageous act interrogated reality, provoked learning, tackled a tough challenge, and enriched the relationship. It is no small thing that as a result the company made the changes necessary to avoid a potential disaster. If you're in a similar situation, I don't advise you to buy a bucket of sand. However, do recognize that there is something within us that responds deeply to people who level with us, who do not pamper us or offer compromises, but instead describe reality so simply and compellingly that the truth seems inevitable and we cannot help but recognize it. And if you are the boss who deserves a bucket of sand, you may have been defending yourself with a complaint, "I pump out energy and it's unilateral. Nothing comes back." Perhaps you're not allowing it to come back. The corporate nod shows up in living rooms as well as boardrooms. Companies and marriages derail temporarily or permanently because people don't say what they are really thinking. No one really asks. No one really answers. Ask yourself, what are my goals when I converse with people? What kinds of things do I usually discuss? Are there other topics that would be more interesting? How often do I find myself, just to be polite, saying things I don't mean? Ask yourself also, how many meetings have I sat in where I knew the real issues were not being discussed? What issues are we avoiding? What has been the economical, emotional, and intellectual cost to the company of not identifying and tackling the real issues? What has been the cost to my marriage? What has been the cost to me? Finally, ask yourself, what is the conversation I've been unable to have with my boss, with my colleagues, with my direct reports, with my customers, with my life partner, and most important, with myself, with my own aspirations, that if I were able to have, might make the difference, might change everything? It would be a gross oversimplification to suggest that each of us simply needs to tell the truth. Will Schutz, who has taught seminars on honesty for decades, suggests that truth is the grand simplifier, that relationships and organizations are simplified, energized, and clarified when they exist in an atmosphere of truth Yet Schutz acknowledges that truth itself is far from simple. Pause for a moment and think about the truth. After all, what is the truth? And does anybody own it? What each of us believes to be true simply reflects our views about reality. When reality changes, and when we ignore competing realities, if we dig in our heels regarding a familiar or favored reality, we may fail. Perhaps what we thought was the truth is no longer the truth in today's environment. For example, most people believe that there are some people you just can't talk to. That, as Satchmo said, some people, if they don't know, you can't tell them. After we've experienced countless failed conversations over the years, such a belief is understandable. I've observed, however, that it is also possible that the way we've been talking with people isn't working, that our techniques for talking with difficult people haven't worked, but other techniques can and do work without rattling sabers or giving ultimatums, that it is our beliefs about what we can say, as well as how and to whom we can say it, that are in the way. If we change our beliefs, productive conversations can easily occur. Most of us find it easier, though, to stick with the reality we've defined by operating from one color stripe on the beach ball. Yet our competitive advantage is to learn from our changing realities and respond quickly. If we entertain multiple realities, it creates possibilities that did not exist for us before. The question is, who owns the truth about what color the company is? The answer? Every single person in the company, including the entry-level file clerk, owns a piece of the truth about what color the company is. The operative word is piece. No one, not even the CEO, owns the entire truth because no one can be in all places at all times. And of course, this applies to our personal relationships. Each of us owns a piece of the truth about what's going on in our marriage. And so does our spouse, so do our kids, and I wouldn't be surprised if the dog had a suggestion or two he'd like to offer. Multiple competing realities existing simultaneously. This is true, and this is true, and this is true. We are more likely to discover the truth we most need to understand today by demonstrating that everyone has a place at the corporate table, that all voices are welcome, that no matter what our area of expertise, each of us has insights and ideas about other aspects of the organization. And while each of us may know a better way for the company to do something, none of us knows more than the sum of everyone's ideas. I heard someone say, "We need to demolish the ensconced." I agree and offer fierce conversations as a marvelous cure for excessive certitude. One of the goals in a fierce conversation is to get everyone's reality out on the table so it can be interrogated. Everyone's. Many a corporate leader has groaned upon considering this point, saying, "Taking the time to interrogate everyone's piece of the truth about what color the company is could take forever. I've got a business to run. Fierce conversations take too much time." I say, not always. I've had fierce conversations that lasted only a few seconds. And it's true, fierce conversations often do take time. Problem is, anything else takes longer. Most leaders have learned from experience that until the multiple, sometimes conflicting realities of key individuals and constituents have been explored, implementing a plan can be a decidedly tentative endeavor. To the degree that you resist or disallow the exploration of differing realities in your workplace and at home, you will spend time, money, energy, and emotion cleaning up the aftermath of plans quietly but effectively torpedoed by individuals who resent that their experience and opinions are apparently of little interest to the organization. There are three stages of interrogating reality. The first is to identify the issue on the table, and if you have a solution in mind, make a proposal. In other words, this is the area of the beach ball we are addressing today, and this is what it looks like from where I stand. Be clear and concise. Say, this is the issue. This is what I propose. An alternative approach is to withhold your ideas until others have shared theirs. However, I find that conversations are best launched when there is a well-defined idea offered as a jumping-off place for everyone's thinking and discussion. If you don't have a proposal, simply identify the issue and proceed. When you are in the presence of knowledgeable but cautious individuals, once you've made your proposal or described the issue, don't just ask, "What do you think?" Invite questions. Check for understanding. This is the second stage of interrogating reality. Say, before we go any further, please ask any clarifying questions you may have. If you notice someone who's silent but looks puzzled or concerned, ask the person, "What questions do you have?" Once you are certain that everyone understands what you are proposing, the third stage is to check for agreement. For example, you could say, "I believe this is the right way to go, the right course of action, but I suspect some of you may see it differently. If you do, I'd like to hear it. I know that my enthusiasm may make it hard to challenge me, but my job is to make the best possible decisions for the organization, not to persuade you to my viewpoint, so please speak up." Then proceed to call on every individual at the table. "Sarah, what are your thoughts? Mike, what's your perspective on this? I invite you to push back on what I've said." This kind of invitation will get people to open up because you publicly, openly, and actively encourage them to share opposing views. You've shown that you are open to rational influence. Do the same thing following the sharing of others' ideas. "Jim, what's your perspective on Mike's idea?" Here's a note of caution. When someone takes you up on your invitation to challenge your strongly held opinion, resist the temptation to defend your idea immediately. So often I've observed teams respond to what appeared to be a sincere invitation, only to be shot down by a leader's knee-jerk attempt to build a stronger case. To everyone in the room, it feels as if the leader is saying, "Apparently you haven't grasped the brilliance of my idea. Let me explain it to you one more time." When we make this mistake, we teach everyone in the room that when we encourage them to challenge our thinking, we don't really mean it. Instead of trying to strengthen your own case, inquire into someone's position. You can say, "Tell us more, Mike. Help us understand your thinking." Thus, the sequence to interrogating reality is, first, make a proposal. Second, check for understanding. And third, check for agreement. By the way, it isn't always helpful to look to the person with the most experience. Instead, look to the person with the best vantage point. Who is standing right at the juncture where things are happening? That person isn't always the designated leader. Also, who stands squarely downstream and therefore will be impacted by any decisions you make? What's the payoff for interrogating multiple realities? People learn to think. Real thinking occurs only when everyone is engaged in exploring different viewpoints. Who knows, you may shift your position as the conversation unfolds. When reality is thoroughly interrogated, participants often walk out of the meeting with ideas that no single individual had walking in. We sometimes discover that we have merely been operating out of the kitchen and living room of our organization, not noticing the highway out front. At times, mastering the courage to interrogate reality has allowed an organization to pull back from the brink of ruin. Very importantly, interrogating reality allows you to generate internal commitment to a decision. People buy into it, even if they don't necessarily agree with it, because their perspective was sought out and valued, and because they genuinely understand why the decision was made. If we can agree that reality is complex, we can probably also agree that the path by which we arrived at our current reality is equally complicated. How do we talk about that? How do we talk about our mistakes and failures without shutting people down, without putting everyone on the defensive? Here's a thought for your consideration. In any situation, the person who can most accurately describe reality without laying blame will emerge the leader, whether designated or not. Author Edwin Friedman said that. Easy to say, hard to do. Most people point the finger. He did it, she did it, they did it, or didn't do it. Such fault-finding invariably provokes all of our defense mechanisms, thus slamming the door on the possibility of frictionless debate and resolution. I witnessed the aftermath of such dynamics several years ago when a new CEO was appointed to lead a company out of a difficult period. I knew quite a few people who worked for the organization. The new CEO, Roger, had a tough job on his hands. Employees had become disillusioned by the behavior of his predecessor. Roger attempted to turn the tide with an iron-fisted style of leadership. It seemed to many that Roger was unwilling to listen to advice and that, in fact, those who challenged his course were considered enemies. They were angry, frustrated, and fearful that the new regime would be just as noxious as the old. The talk in the hallways and private offices was grim. Another failure of leadership seemed inevitable. Many withdrew their support of Roger, and he received the unfortunate nickname of Dead Man Walking. At an informal staff gathering in the lunchroom, as several employees recounted Roger's latest missteps, one employee, Elizabeth, said, "I'm troubled at what we're doing here. I confess I've been guilty of bashing Roger, and I'm sitting here feeling ashamed." Guiding the organization at this time would be a thankless and difficult job for anyone. Morale is in the tank, revenues are sliding, customers are complaining, and our leader is doing his level best to lead us through this morass and out the other side. I wonder what we could do to support him in his endeavor. Another employee responded, "Come on, Elizabeth, nobody can talk to Roger. You can't tell him anything." Elizabeth said, "Well, then how can we make ourselves the kind of people he will listen to? Maybe we need to change our approach. And how well do we understand the current strategy? Since change has to be the order of the day, perhaps we could learn a thing or two." The mood shifted around the table as individuals contemplated the possibilities and began to offer suggestions. Elizabeth asked for a meeting with Roger the next day and began their conversation with these words, "I'm here for two reasons. First, to apologize for my criticism of you behind your back and for my lack of support. I realize that my attitude has been a hindrance, and I want you to know that I've got a greatly improved attitude today. I'd like to help you in any way I can." "Secondly," she continued, "I'd like to suggest a meeting with the staff. As our leader, you need our support, and I'd like you to receive it. Some potentially good ideas have been withheld from you because of fear of reprisal. I hope you'll entertain them and also share with the staff as many details as possible about your strategy for this coming year and the thinking behind it. I believe this could serve as a turning point for all of us and for the company." Over the next few months, Elizabeth emerged as a highly respected agent for positive change in her organization. And what about on the home front? How do we describe reality without laying blame when someone we love behaves in ways that are damaging to the relationship? A friend told me of an internal struggle she had recently when she attended a local festival with someone new in her life. "We were sitting at a table in the beer garden when this couple at the next table struck up a conversation with us. Before I knew it, Ben was engaged in an enthusiastic conversation with a woman. He had his back turned to me, and they were obviously enjoying talking about several experiences they discovered they had in common. The conversation went on and on. Finally, after about 20 minutes, Ben turned to me and asked, 'Am I ignoring you?' I answered with a rather sarcastic, 'Yes.' Neither of us knew what to do after that. The rest of the afternoon was strained, and I didn't like how I felt. I was upset and disappointed that Ben had ignored me for so long, but I didn't want to start a fight. I was afraid that if I said what I was thinking, it would come out all wrong." As we talked, my friend pieced together what had happened for her. "I'm still getting to know Ben," she said. "However, I believe he genuinely cares for me. I think he was just enjoying himself, not flirting, and that what I felt was about me, not about Ben. I've never wanted to feel I had to compete for the attention of the man in my life. I could have insinuated myself into the conversation, but I didn't, and I don't believe I ever would try to do that. If a similar situation occurs, I'll let Ben know this about me, she concluded. It might help him to understand this about me, and I might learn more about him. What an elegant approach to a bump in the relationship road. No blame, just, this is what's going on for me. I thought you should know. To help you improve at describing reality without laying blame, a simple and effective shift you can make is to remove the word but from your vocabulary and substitute the word and. I like what you've done here, but will be better received if you say, I like what you've done here, and. For example, in a conversation with an employee, this is how things typically go. I know you want more time to complete the project, but the deadline is looming. You want me to help out in Boston, but I only have a small window in which to make some critical things happen in Seattle. I'd like to help you, but I have no easy choices right now. You seem stressed, but I hold you able to deliver this project on time with minimal involvement on my part. In other words, this is true, but this is true too. Multiple realities are competing, and I've got to choose one or the other. Sorry, you lose. If you substituted and every time you would ordinarily use the word but, the conversation might go like this. I know you want more time to complete the project, and the deadline is looming. You want me to help out in Boston, and I only have a small window in which to make some critical things happen in Seattle. I'd like to help you, and I have no easy choices right now. You seem stressed, and I hold you able to deliver this project on time with minimal involvement on my part. That feels better, doesn't it, to both parties? This is true, and this is true. Multiple realities are not competing, they just exist. You own a piece of the truth, and so do I. Let's figure out what to do. Over the next 24 hours, practice describing reality accurately without laying blame at home and in your workplace. To help you with this assignment, catch yourself whenever you are about to say but and replace it with and. Most people are shocked to discover how many times they use the word but during the course of a day. Each time you describe reality accurately without laying blame, you create a kind of force field around yourself, one that feels good to others. When you practice describing reality without laying blame, notice the change in the tone and the outcome of your conversations as you make the subtle change of deleting the word but from your vocabulary. Here's a true story that illustrates how a powerful conversational model can be used to tackle multiple realities. John Tompkins, the CEO of a commercial fishing fleet, looks like a seawall against which many a ship has wrecked. He is 6'6". He has girth. He looks solid. He smiles warmly as he greets me in the reception area of his company. I think I notice a slight limp and, like a fool, glance to see if he has a peg leg. As we shake hands, I think, if we were choosing sides, I'd want to be on his team. John had called me in to help him prepare for a meeting with 55 key employees. On the phone, John had said they had a few challenges, some things he hoped to resolve while everyone was in town during shipyard, the repair and refitting of ships. A week later, I sink into the leather sofa in John's office and ask him what the issues are. There are two, John says. The first is there isn't enough communication between the vessel personnel and the office staff. The vessel personnel catch and process fish, he explains. That's their job. Here in the office, it's our job to support the vessels. When something breaks on one of the vessels, if they don't have the extra part they need, we get it to them. If someone gets sick, we get them off the ship and replace them. It's critical that vessel and office personnel stay current regarding performance, how much fish each vessel has caught, how crew members are doing. Based on results, we move our vessels to different fishing waters or replace crew members. The problem is, nobody is talking to anybody else. The vessel crew are out there busting their butts to catch fish. If they don't catch fish, none of us would have a job. They're frustrated at the way the office staff treat them. They feel the people in the office don't value what they do or understand how hard the work is. Meanwhile, the office staff are convinced the vessel personnel think they just sit around smoking cigars. Okay, what's the second issue? I asked. John takes a deep breath and looks at the floor. I thought, this one's closer to home and close to the bone. Looks like this one hurts. I've got two talented guys, Ken and Rick. Handling operations, he said. Rick helped me get the company started, so when I hired Ken and put him in charge, Rick was angry. I had my reasons. Rick is a hothead. Ken's better at working through issues with people, thinking through how things should be handled. I thought Rick would get over it, but it's been a year and he's still angry, and he's found a million ways to sabotage Ken. He's even been caught in some lies. I raise my eyebrows. John shrugs. I know you're wondering why he's still here. Well, I'm wondering if you've considered making him available to industry. John chuckles. That's good. The latest euphemism. John shakes his head. Rick's too good to lose. Now I'm thinking you get what you tolerate. John nods, grimacing. I ask permission to talk with people in the office and on the vessels. I learned a lot of great phrases. The fish rots from the head. This is true. The breadcrumbs always lead to the CEO, or in this case, the fish master. The stories rolled out. Here is some of what I learned. If you go fishing with a bunch of your buddies, what do you hope will happen? You hope you catch the biggest fish, the most fish. The captain and crew of fishing boats want bragging rights. After all, they have their reputations in the industry and significant personal income at stake. What if you go fishing with somebody you don't like? You conceal your pleasure when they don't catch any fish at all, and you give them lousy advice. All of the vessels were competing with one another. When they found good waters, the fish masters on each vessel would withhold information about their location. Ken and Rick each favored a particular vessel, different ones, so they fought to make sure their favorite vessel got the best equipment so it could catch the most fish. Ken and Rick's competition had spread to all vessel personnel on those two vessels. The two vessels and all hands were at war. The other vessels felt like ugly stepchildren operationally adrift. There are rules about drinking and fraternization on factory trawlers, but all the vessels held impressive quantities of booze. One fish master drank and fraternized at a decidedly intimate level with several of the galley workers. HR knew it, but his vessel caught more fish than anyone anywhere, so everybody looked the other way. The vessel crew broke their backs to catch fish, and they were good at it. If they didn't catch fish, the office staff wouldn't have a cushy office to come to every day. Add to that the hardship of the work itself, plus being away from their families for months, cooped up in the bowels of a floating tin can, and if they didn't catch fish, they didn't make money, at least not enough to compensate for the hardship. It is a tough life, but they would be a lot happier if they felt as if the office staff appreciated what they did, what they endure. The office staff resented living on call day and night during fishing season to support vessel personnel who wouldn't send in reports or return calls. Meanwhile, they were trying to sell a product. If they didn't sell the product at a good price, the company didn't turn a profit. The office staff needed to know how the vessels were doing out there. They needed accurate reports. Because of the competition between Ken and Rick, some of the reports were greatly exaggerated. As I share my discoveries with John, he leans forward with his head in his hands and stares morosely at the carpet. When I describe a particularly colorful detail of what is happening and the outcomes, John groans softly. I hate conflict. A sigh. Then he looks me in the eye and says, "It's important to me to be liked." I smile. You're in excellent company. As the facilitator, I will ensure that the scheduled meeting with employees takes place within important guidelines. However, tackling these issues will not be easy for John. So after I've gotten a picture of what is going on with him, I move to the conversation model I use more often than any other with clients. Years ago, this model was named Mineral Rights by a workshop participant who suggested, if you're drilling for water, it's better to drill 100-foot well than 100 one-foot wells. This conversation interrogates reality by mining for increased clarity, improved understanding, and impetus for change. Mineral Rights will help you drill down deep on a topic by asking your colleague, customer, boss, direct report, spouse, child, or friend a series of questions. This is not painful dentistry drilling sans Novocaine. It's a natural exploration that accomplishes all four purposes of a fierce conversation. Interrogate reality, provoke learning, tackle tough challenges, and enrich relationships. My mineral rights conversation with John took about an hour. Here's an abbreviated version of the conversation. John, of the issues we've uncovered, which one, when resolved, will give you the greatest return on investment of whatever time, energy, and dollars you allocate to it? The competition between Ken and Rick. Okay, summarize for me the current impact of this competition. Well, the problems between Ken and Rick translate to competition between vessels and goes directly to the bottom line. When a favored vessel ends up with better equipment than the others, it performs better. The others are struggling to do their best with marginal equipment. John, who else is being impacted? What else? Morale, the lowest it's ever been. Key personnel are threatening to leave. I've got some great talent here and I don't want to lose them. I can't afford to. How is it impacting the company? We're not as profitable as we should be, as we could be. Frankly, I'm fed up. You're fed up. Talk to me about what you're feeling, how this is impacting you. When grown men, highly skilled, act like children, it's beyond frustrating. It's maddening. We are one company. Many ships, one company. If they can't see that, what are you feeling? Betrayed. I feel betrayed. John, imagine that it's 6 months from now, a year from now, and nothing has changed. What are the implications? Oh, I'd have to fire myself, say to hell with it. What's at stake for you to lose or gain? Millions of dollars, pleasure in the work, self-esteem, physical health. John, what are you pretending not to know about your contribution to this situation being exactly the way it is? I don't understand. I don't know. What would it be if you did know? I haven't outlined clear consequences. If Ken and Rick's rivalry continues, my guess is they doubt I'd pull the trigger on those consequences and fire one of them if they can't work together. Are they right? No. No. If this doesn't stop, one of them will have to go. John, let's shift gears. Let's imagine you've tackled this head on and the issue is resolved. What difference will that make? All the difference. All the vessels would be equally well equipped. Everybody would catch more fish, which translates into better profitability for the company. Higher profits would allow us to upgrade equipment, expand the fleet. As they say, all ships would rise, and I'd sleep better. I wouldn't be thinking of selling the whole damn thing. When you consider those outcomes, what do you feel? Hope. Things would be a lot more fun around here. I wouldn't feel like the Lone Ranger. Then, given everything we've talked about, what's the next most potent step you can take to improve this issue prior to the company meeting? Talk to Ken and Rick, individually and together, one more time. What's going to try to get in your way? My need to be liked, which translates into rarely making clear requests with consequences attached. John, what's your ideal outcome? They stop competing and work as a team. I don't lose either one of them. If the competition